Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello everyone, you're listening to What's the Crack, and today I'm interviewing Steve Rolls, a senior policy analyst for Transform Drug Policy Foundation in the UK. In today's episode, me and Steve find out what's the crack with drug policy reform, the failure of the war on drugs, the ideal drugs policy, and the recent changes in cannabis policy. I hope you enjoy the episode, and remember to follow up on Twitter at WhatTheCrackPod or email us at WhatsTheCrackPodcast@gmail.com. Also, I've introduced a new section called The Golden Ticket, where I ask my guests what drug policy they would introduce or remove immediately if they could. So keep tuned for that. Enjoy the episode. Hi, Steve. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, my name's Steve Rolls, and I'm the Senior Policy Analyst for Transform Drug Policy Foundation. And Transform is a non-government organisation based in the UK but operating internationally. We're a registered charity. We're sometimes called a think tank, but it's not a term I'm particularly crazy on. I mean, we do policy analysis around drug policy and drug law reform. And then we do various advocacy and campaigning related to that work. And a particular focus of our work historically has been on the legalisation and regulation of drugs. So, you know, what would the world look like after the war on drugs? How would we function and how would policy work in a post-prohibition scenario, whether it's in a single country, in a whole region, or potentially the whole world? So we've done a lot of quite detailed work modelling how drug regulation can work to serve the public interest, to improve public health and reduce crime and protect young people. And we've been doing it for about 20 years. So we've been at it quite a long time. And it feels like the world is either we're succeeding and in persuading people, or the world is kind of catching up with us because it's started to move from theory into practice. And you know, lots of countries are actually either talking about it and a few of them are actually doing it. So Transform's profile is rising both in the UK and internationally, and it's a very exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely. You say that Transform has been going for over 20 years, and the internet tells me that you've been with the foundation since 1998. What would you say has been the biggest difference in UK drug policy that you've seen happen in that period of time?
Well, I mean, relatively little has changed in legal terms. And in some ways, things have actually got worse because we've now got the Psychoactive Substances Act, which basically bans anything deemed to be psychoactive. So you know, friends and colleagues have teased me that I've been doing it for 20 years and there's trying to legalize drugs in the UK, and there's more drugs illegal than when I started, which is technically correct. I think what's changed is not so much the law, but to a certain extent, how the law is being enforced and how it's being used. And I think those changes reflect a wider shift, a positive shift in the general debate, in the media, in the public, and in the political domain about drugs. It seems like there's a growing acknowledgement that the historical approach to kind of punitive orientation of drug policy and the enforcement skew of drug policy resources has not been effective. I mean, I think it's hard to question that, really. I mean, that drug policy aspires to get rid of drugs and reduce drug availability and deter drug use. as a way of protecting public health, and it's clearly not doing that. It's fueling crime. It's making drugs more dangerous. Drug markets are expanding. Use of a lot of the most dangerous drugs is expanding. Historically, drug use has been on a fairly relentless march upwards, with a few little downtrends with certain drugs and certain populations. But, you know, it hasn't delivered what it was supposed to, and it's created all these other secondary costs associated with a you know, multi-billion pound illegal trade. So it's been a disaster by any measure. And I think there's a general, you know, I think there's a general acceptance that the war on drugs, as it's sometimes referred to, hasn't worked, and that we need to begin a meaningful adult discussion about what to do instead, or what might replace the war on drugs. And I think that's where Transform and a number of other organizations in the UK and internationally have come in and tried to sort of fill that gap and inform that debate. And I think that's where things have moved on, really. Even if the law hasn't changed for the better yet, the debate has certainly become a lot more informed and sophisticated. And public opinion has certainly moved away from the war on drugs towards a broader sort of reform platform. And we're beginning to see that in not so much in central government policy, but in local government policy. So we're seeing a lot of sort of local level reforms, like drug testing at festivals from The Loop, for example. A lot of local authorities are now trying to set up drug consumption rooms to deal with problems of opioid overdose. And we're even seeing a number of police authorities putting in place diversion schemes. So people caught in possession for personal use are diverted away from the criminal justice system into some kind of health intervention, which is a kind of de facto decriminalisation of personal use. So there is movement, but not really from central government yet, except very recently, arguably, for medical cannabis, although in some ways that's a slightly peripheral secondary issue when if we're talking about recreational drugs. But it still probably reflects a general shift, a positive shift in the drugs debate, that ministers and politicians feel comfortable now to advocate for even medical cannabis reform.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you were talking about the diversion of cannabis. Is this the example of Durham, who have decided not to charge people for the possession of cannabis? Is that the same topic?
Yes. But it's not just, I mean, Durham and Bristol police authorities, they're not. It's not just cannabis. It's all drugs. I mean, if you're caught with a small amount of drugs for personal use, you aren't automatically prosecuted. The idea is that you'll go into a particular intervention, and it varies between the police authorities. But the idea essentially is not to give you a criminal record, and certainly not to send you to jail, because we know from, you know, decades of experience that that's pointless, expensive, and counterproductive. It makes people's lives more difficult, particularly if they're already disadvantaged, to then have to deal with a criminal record. It's just incredibly stupid and counterproductive thing to do. So the police know that better than anybody, really, because they're the ones there on the front line enforcing the law. And as the police get their resources squeezed, in a lot of ways, the police are leading a lot of the local level reforms, because they're becoming increasingly intolerant of hosing money and resources at enforcing laws that they see as pointless and ineffectual. And often actually making things worse, because obviously if you're a police force enforcing the drug laws, which probably affect about a third or half of the young people that you're interacting with, that actually, you know, undermines relationships with young people in a way that's really destructive, and that the police start being seen as the enemy instead of being there to protect people, which is just it's all the wrong way around. So the police, ironically enough, are driving a lot of the reforms in the UK, and that's very welcome. What hasn't happened yet is that the central government and the Home Office haven't sort of picked up the baton and shown any leadership on this. So we've seen this kind of slightly strange delegation of leadership from the Home Office to local police forces in terms of innovative drug policy reforms. But there are things happening, and I think that's really, really welcome.
Yeah, and speaking of not getting young people into the criminal justice system for possession, do you not think that this is the minor, I mean very minor, saving grace of the Psychoactive Substances Act? The fact that possession is not a crime? Because as much as I disagreed with the act fully, I was really grateful that the possession was actually not a crime.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that was the one good thing you could say about that terrible bill. A pointless, idiotic piece of legislation was that it didn't criminalise possession. But it does beg the question, you know, it's interesting. The Home Office made that decision not to criminalise possession of drugs under that particular bill on advice from a number of experts and expert advice and agencies that it would unnecessarily criminalise young people, it would undermine relationships between young people and police. And would be pointless and counterproductive. At which point you have to say, well, how does that not apply to other drugs? And of course it does. That analysis, it doesn't make any distinction between drugs. It's a purely arbitrary legal distinction, which drugs are covered by the Psychoactive Substances Act and which ones are covered by the Misuse of Drugs Act. So we've got it's just very inconsistent, hypocritical. And when you ask the Home Office, you sort of say, well, why aren't we looking at decriminalisation? It's advocated by the World Health Organization, by the Royal Society of Public Health, by the Royal College of Physicians, by the International Red Cross, by the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, and so on and so on, and by the Advisory Council on Misuse of Drugs, the Home Office's own expert advisory body. They all advocate for ending the criminalisation of users, of people who use drugs. And yet the Home Office refuses to countenance it. When you ask them about it, they just say, look, drugs are bad for you and we're not going to decriminalise. And you go, well, hang on, what about the Psychoactive Substances Act? Because you did effectively decriminalise possession there. And they just sort of splutter and avoid the question, basically, because there's no defending that kind of inconsistency. And hopefully decriminalisation of people who use drugs, minor possession offences, the removal of criminal penalties for that, I think it's probably nearer than people think it is. I mean, we've got countries all over the world have done it. The evidence base for it is very strong. The expert institutional support for it is very strong. And in fact, you've got police forces in the UK are already effectively doing it, in that people caught in possession aren't being charged. They're being directed into health interventions. So it's sort of happening, and I think that's probably nearer than many people think. I think one of the problems actually is the word decriminalisation, because people don't understand it, and it's often confused with legalisation, which is obviously, I think, an important thing to be talking about, but it is different. Legalisation is of the production and supply for adult use of drugs. Decriminalisation is simply removing criminal penalties for possession, so the supply would remain illegal under a decrim model like Portugal. So there's a lot of confusion, and it may be that it's more useful to talk about terms like diversion. So the police initiatives in Durham and Bristol, they talk about diversion programs, diverting people from the criminal justice system into appropriate health interventions. But it is happening. I think it's probably nearer than many people think.
Yeah, I think that you're right with the decriminalisation language. I've only met a handful of people outside the drugs field that used decriminalisation in the correct context. Like, the amount of people who assume that drugs are legal in Portugal is quite surprising. So, yeah, maybe we need to change the name.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, you often get media articles where someone will have called for legalization and the headline will say decriminalization, or the other way around. And you even get media articles from decent outlets, like the New York Times, the Guardian and so on. Where they'll use decriminalisation and legalisation interchangeably, which is just, it's just annoying from a kind of pedantic point of view, but it's actually confusing for the public. And I think it can hold up the progression of the debate. So one thing I do is, if I talk about decriminalisation, I try and always explain what it is. So I'll say ending the criminal penalties for minor possession offences, or, ending the criminalisation of people who use drugs. And then maybe if there's time to be explicit that is different from legalization. They're both important, and they're linked and overlapping, but they're not the same. And we need to be clear about that, because there will probably be a sort of incremental process of reform, and it will inevitably start with a decriminalization. So we need to be clear that they're not the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so looking out of the UK, what country or area of said country do you think has the right policy for a particular drug? For example, perhaps it is Canada for cannabis or Portugal for the decriminalization of opioids. Is there a particular country that has done it right with a particular drug?
Well, I mean, building on what I just said, I mean, in terms of decriminalization approaches, I think Portugal has received a lot of attention deservedly, because I think they've gone about it in a very sensible, pragmatic, evidence-based way. They didn't just change the law; they also reoriented their whole policy and resources accordingly, away from criminal justice towards public health. So they invested a lot in harm reduction and treatment and outreach to vulnerable populations. And it's been very effective. So I think it's not just changing the law. It's more you have to sort of shift the whole paradigm from a kind of criminal justice paradigm towards a public health paradigm. And I think Portugal is a good example of that. But obviously they haven't legalized. You know, drugs are still illegal in Portugal, and they are still supplied by organized crime and unregulated dealers, which is a shame. But you know, one step at a time. In terms of legalization regulation. I mean, most of the action has been with cannabis, I guess, understandably, because cannabis is generally seen to be at the lower end of the risk spectrum amongst the illegal drugs, or certainly the ones that are widely used. It's particularly difficult to enforce the law against cannabis because it's just so easy to grow pretty much anywhere. And people like it. It's just very popular because people enjoy using it. And so it's widely used. It's impossible to enforce. It's not unacceptably risky. And for that reason, a lot of the progress has been with cannabis. In terms of who's done it best, I mean, really, we're looking at the Americas here. So Uruguay has gone for a much stricter kind of state controlled, almost a state monopoly model, where you can only buy unbranded government licensed products of fixed potency at fixed price from pharmacies. The American reforms at state level in places like California and Colorado and Washington and Oregon and so on have tended to be much more commercialized models. So it's a bit more like alcohol, you know, with branded products and a certain amount of advertising. And Canada has, I think, is sort of somewhere between the two of those. It's not as state controlled as Uruguay, but it's not as commercialized as in the US. So the cannabis products that are going to be sold in Canada have to be in plain packaging with health warnings on. They can have a small branding and logo, but essentially they'll look a bit more like pharmaceuticals. That they're going to be sold in most provinces, they'll be sold from state controlled outlets. So there's a state monopoly on the retailing, but not the production. And there's going to be very strict controls on advertising and promotions. So Canada, I think, probably is a good model, is a good sort of reasonable middle ground, very much rooted in a sort of public health ethos. And I hope it's successful. But the shops haven't even opened in Canada yet, so that doesn't happen until October. So we obviously have to wait and see how that's unfolding. But even the ones that are less to my taste, the more commercial models in the US, you look at the outcomes of those ones, and they're still pretty good. I mean, you know, there hasn't been a terrible spike in use. There hasn't been a sort of leap in cannabis impaired driving accidents. There's been a massive drop in arrests and criminalization, particularly of young people. And there's been substantial tax revenue generated, some of which has been, you know, directed into, drug prevention and other sort of social goods. So even what I would view as the worst of the legal models isn't that bad. And it's not really bad at all in terms of its outcomes.
Well, yeah, I hope it works out right. I'm really rooting for Canada with the hope that legalization actually achieves the aims and positive outcomes, not only for the Canadian people, but also for other countries looking to change their drug policy.
Well, I mean, I should confess that I was, you know, peripherally at least involved in the cannabis reform process in Canada as an advisor to the Federal Task Force, who produced a report and recommendations that formed the basis of the Cannabis Act, Cannabis Regulation Act. And I was also involved in Uruguay, actually, as an advisor to the Uruguayan government. But where I haven't been involved is in the US, kind of because they have their own ecosystem of activists and policy experts. So they had less need for sort of external advisors in the US. There's a lot of variation in the US as well. I mean, you can't generalize that there's was it 9 states now or 8 states, and they've done it in very different ways. So Vermont has just legalized, actually, but they don't have a commercial market. They have at the moment, a give and grow, it's called, where you're allowed to grow in the home and you're allowed to share on a non-profit basis, but there's no kind of commercial retail market there. At least there isn't yet, which is itself quite an interesting model. But that's very, very different from what's going on in Colorado or California, where you have more conventional shops with cool signs outside selling, an array of cannabis products, many of them branded inside. So that you need to be careful not to generalize about the US experience.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so in both cases in the US and Canada, over half of the US have a legal medical market and Canada have had a medical market since 2001. And now there's a lot of talk about medical cannabis in the UK. So do you think changing laws around the medical use of cannabis is a key movement for the recreational market, or do you think it should be kept separate as it's just been coincidental that a medical market has come before it?
No, I mean, they're undoubtedly linked within the sort of political discourse, but I'm uneasy about the way that they're often conflated, because I think they are very different. I mean, the nature of medicines regulation is very different from the nature of a regulatory system for a recreational drug, in terms of its goals, in terms of the mechanisms and regulatory agencies and so on. So I think it's very important to keep them separate in terms of discussing policy. But they do overlap, undoubtedly. I mean, I think one of the problems with development and use of medical cannabis-based medicines and research around cannabis-based medicines has been the wider environment of, drug war politics. So that's been very unfortunate. And then it's something that David Nutt's spoken about a lot, is that he it's very difficult to do research on drugs that are in Schedule 1. It's actually easier to do. He was saying it's easier for him to do research into heroin than it is to do research into cannabis, which is, a ridiculous state of affairs. So there is an overlap, both in terms of the political discourse and in terms of some of the questions around regulation. But there are also significant differences, and I think we need to try and keep those two issues separate as far as possible. But I think that the fact that the medical cannabis issue has suddenly opened up in the UK, there's been a head of steam building around that for a long time. And there's been lots of NGOs and activists and parliamentary activity going on at an increasing intensity over the last couple of years. But it was pushed over the line, obviously, by the Billy Caldwell story and the Alfie Dingley story and the tabloids jumped on these stories, and the media generally, in fact, jumped on these stories of this poor kid with epilepsy. And I think that's been very useful. I think congratulations are due to the people who VoltFast and UPA and some of the other organisations that orchestrated those media campaigns. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant that that's happened. It's brilliant that people soon will have access to cannabis-based medicines that are potentially useful for them. And it does reflect the changing times, I think, in the drugs debate, that people aren't quite so terrified of drugs. It's not so you can suddenly you can talk about this without being,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Labeled some sort of evil legalizer or sort of, you know, being off your head on drugs or whatever other cliche stereotypes have been thrown at reformers. So it reflects the changing times. Is it going to help the recreational cannabis debate? I don't know. I mean, I expect it will if it reduces some of the sort of stigma about talking about cannabis regulation. But again, I have this sort of unease that the two things can be conflated. But certainly historically, in most places, medical cannabis has come first. And I guess that's not really surprising, because I think sick people should be a priority over people who want to get high. But it's also, we've got the mounting evidence from around the world. I mean, the fact you've got countries all over the world now are implementing or have implemented legal cannabis access for medical uses of one form or another. It also makes it increasingly difficult for the government to deny that cannabis is a use, cannabis-based medicines can be useful, and to sort of deny that it's possible to regulate them, because clearly it is possible.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, and the fact that I don't necessarily like them being linked together, the medical and the recreation. But I do think it's good in changing the mindset of having a constant dialogue in your head telling you that drugs are bad. So with the fact that the medical market suggests that drugs can actually do good, which makes me think that there's a potential for psychedelics, which have been in trials for medical use with mental health illnesses, such as LSD and psilocybin for depression or MDMA for PTSD. So it makes me think that we could get to a point where people think, oh, this drug isn't all bad, you know?
I think so, but again, I'm wary, because, you know, it may, you know, fentanyl has medical uses, but recreationally, it's a nightmare. So, you know, you have to be careful. Ketamine has medical uses, but, you know, any of these drugs can be used medically, but they can, their recreational uses can also be potentially very risky. You know, cannabis itself is not with it. It may be lower risk relative to some of these other things, but it's not zero risk. So again, I'm a bit wary of sort of going, well, look, this is a medicine. How bad can it be? And you kind of go, fentanyl, you know, heroin is a medicine. Cocaine is a medicine. Methamphetamine is a medicine. These are all in the lock cabinet in any hospital in the UK. But they're also potentially can be very dangerous if used misused. So I just feel we need to be a bit careful there. And it comes back to my general desire to see the medical and non-medical debates kept separate, acknowledging the overlaps, both politically and practically, but for the most part, I think best kept apart.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to ask a question that's a little broader than just for cannabis. But why do you think that the war on drugs has been so resilient to change?
Well, that is a very good question. And I think for me, I feel like the war on drugs is sort of operated in a different space from normal sort of evidence-based social policy norms. It's been very much framed in sort of binary moral terms, as, you know, drugs are bad or even drugs are evil. So, you know, drugs are described as evil in the UN 1961 UN Drug Convention. Because of that evil, we have a duty to combat them. That's the language used in the UN Convention, which is the kind of founding document of global prohibition. And once you frame the issue in those terms as evil, and these sort of, you know, it's very black and white terms, an evil against which we must sort of declare war, you move the debate into a very different space. It becomes, you know, fighting that evil becomes sort of righteous in and of itself, and you don't need scrutiny, you don't need evidence and evaluation, because we're fighting evil, like we're fighting an invading army, we're fighting the Nazis, we're fighting the bad guys. And so drugs has been framed in those terms, as, you know, an existential threat to our society and a threat to our health and a threat to our security and a threat to our children that we must fight against. And in that context, you don't need evidence of effectiveness. And that's good for people who fought for the drug warriors, because there isn't any evidence of effectiveness by any, you know, objective measures, it's been a complete disaster. But it hasn't. It's not systematically evaluated. Its ineffectiveness is not. Well, it hasn't until relatively recently been meaningfully scrutinized, and that just makes it easy for it to become a political enterprise rather than a more standard social policy evidence based enterprise. And I think that's what's happened. You know, politicians have and policymakers and leaders around the world have benefited from drug war rhetoric. They hype up a threat and then they put themselves forward as protecting the people and the children and so on from that threat. And it's in some ways that you can see a sort of overlap with some of the immigration debate. You know, all these horrible foreigners are coming into our country and they're like Trump talking about rapists and thieves and murderers. And he will protect us from them. It's a bit like that with drugs. You know, it's presented as a threat, and politicians present themselves as the tough enforcers who are going to protect us from that threat. And in that context, it doesn't need any evaluation or scrutiny. And politicians have become so sort of almost addicted to that sort of drug war, tough talking enforcement rhetoric, and the moral sort of binary nature of it that they've kind of talked themselves into a corner, and it becomes very difficult for a lot of politicians who've bought into that drug war rhetoric to move away from it, because you know, if you've talking about war and fighting and combat, if you move away from that and fighting this evil and fighting this threat, if you start to move away from that, you can be seen or portrayed as surrendering or as weak or as not tough anymore. And politicians don't like that. They like to be seen as strong, and the war on drugs has played into that. And I think that's, to me, that, I mean, there's lots of other things going on, but that's at the heart of the problem, is this sort of deeply, profoundly, culturally entrenched drug war narrative that it's very, very difficult for politicians to snap out of. But the optimistic note to end on with that is that I think that things are changing. That narrative doesn't work as well now as it did 5 or 10 or 20 years ago, because the critique of the failing of the war on drugs has become so prevalent. You just can't get away with it anymore, and you can't say those things without being challenged. So things are changing, but it's taken a long time to unpick that rhetoric and that narrative.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a positive place to take us to our final question. My question on the golden ticket. If you were given a golden ticket for one drug policy to be implemented immediately, what would you choose and why? Or, on the flip side, what drug policy would you remove and why?
Well, that's one of those questions, a bit like where you say, if you get given one wish and you ask for three more wishes.
Are you going to ask for more wishes?
What I would legalize all drugs globally.
There you go, the biggest wish.
Yeah, I think what I would do is I'd like to see a paradigm shift away from an ideologically driven criminal justice and punitive enforcement paradigm that has dominated the discourse for the last 20 or 30 years towards one that is very much more rooted in public health, community safety, and human rights. Because I think if we prioritize those things, if we prioritize public health and human rights and community safety and development and security, if we prioritize those and we meaningfully evaluate the different alternative options to see which ones deliver on those priorities, it only points in one direction, and it's never going to be towards a war on drugs.
Awesome, thank you. Is there anything else you would like to add or plug?
No, I think I've been. Burbling on probably for far too long already. I mean, if anyone wants to find out more about Transform, check out our website, which is tdpf.org.uk, or just Google Transform Drugs. You can follow me on Twitter on @SteveTransform. If people are supportive or interested in the work we do, please get in touch, because it's really important as we move forward with the reform agenda that people get involved, because we can't do it all by ourselves.
Well, thank you, Steve. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
All right, fantastic. Well, look, good to talk to you. Good luck with it all. And yeah, stay in touch.
And that was our interview with Steve Rolls. Check out Transform Drug Policy Foundation online, follow them and Steve on Twitter, and join the movement. See you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.